Okay, let's do a little bit of Tzav, and against Ariel's wishes, let's do something on Purim while we're doing it.
It's time.
No, this is a... I was having a back and forth a little bit with this with Rai Foreman yesterday, so it's on my mind anyways. There are a series of Midrashic traditions that seem to point us in the direction, which, to be fair, emerges somewhat from Pshat, but the Midrashic traditions highlight it, that part of the problem that we have with Achashverosh is that he was replacing God. Right? He was attempting to replace God. Right? We have a lot of Minhagim, by the way. Right? We have a lot of Minhagim that point in this direction. Right? Now, by the way, and that his house was the sort of subversion of the Mikdash. Yeah. Right, the most famous of the Midrashim that points in that direction is
they were using the Kalim
and Mikdash, which is anachronistic, right? Because I'll peep shat hadvarim based on what we know of history. Why is that problematic?
Because they were already
because the Jews were already rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash at that time, right? And Cyrus had sent them, right? So what? So Al-Pi-Pshat, Cyrus had already sent them, and the problem is that this is a very diasporic work, right, where this whole problem is happening specifically to the people who did not return to Eretz Yisrael, which complicates the entire story, which is why sort of a lot of the modern reads, especially in Israel, of Megad Esther are like, this is a critique of those people who are, anyways. Now there are other ones, obviously, that point to this connection between Achashverosh trying to replace himself as God, and therefore his house is replacing the Mishkan, right? This subversion. I don't remember who pointed this out. It was one of the shiurim I was listening to a few weeks ago. Maybe it was Ray Clapper pointed it out to me. But why is it that we refer to God as Melech Malchei Hamlachim?
Because he's the King of the King of Kings.
Yeah, what the heck does the King of the King of Kings mean?
Achashverosh is the King of Kings.
The Emperor, King of King, Malchei Hamlachim means Emperor. And in the Age of Empires, the King, right, Achashverosh was the King of Kings. Yes, because he's the Emperor, not the King, right? He's the King over 127 Medinot, which might have their own independent rulers, but he's the Emperor.
Up until 1979.
And therefore, Melech Malchei Hamlachim...
Moshe means Emperor.
What?
Moshe means Emperor.
No, but descriptively, right? Okay, Malchei Hamlachim, right, meaning if you have an empire, then the Emperor is the Malchei Hamlachim, which means that if God wants to describe himself as above them, he has to be the Emperor of Emperors, right? That would be a more...
Right.
Now... And it's clear, therefore, that the fact that God never appears, right, Achashverosh does every time that he's supposed to, right, obviously the lack, right, meaning this is, there are many vorts in the Megillah, but one of them is that the reason God's name is not there, besides for it being a very, sort of, Neis al derech hateva, is also the fact that the whole atmosphere of Persia, right, makes it that God is invisible. Right now, certain of our Minhagim are meant to draw attention to this, like Hamelech. Where we in the middle of the Megillah and Perek Vav, we invoke Rosh Hashanah tune talking about God for Achashverosh, because it's Balayla hi nadida shnat Hamelech, right? And we literally it means Achashverosh, but really it means that God has started to shake things up in the story, but. The point is, that the Midrash really does point you in this direction that part of the problem of the culture of Shushan and the Jews' involvement in it is that the atmosphere of that empire, which deified the king, to the exclusion of all else... again, whether or not it was in the way that Paro does it, where he actually calls himself a god, or just in the way we sort of drashically talk about it in the 21st century, right? That anything that has taken over people's lives is the new Avodah Zarah, right? Meaning at some level that's true, right? Meaning in the sense that, yes, if you have a king who makes the entire world revolve around him, then...
There's a
Tom of Avodah Zarah. And if you look through the Megillah, you will find certain references that might stare you in the face that would point that would highlight this. So the one I sent to Ray Foreman because he didn't mention it in his podcast on it, but I think for me is quite a striking one is why does Esther have to send messengers to Mordecai outside the palace, and why can't Mordecai come in?
Can't come in the palace unless you're approved by the king.
No.
Mordecai didn't want to go.
Because you can't come into the palace
unless you're
dressed royal. In the vursak.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Right? Right? Dressed in clothes of the mourning.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
Neither can the Kohanim enter the Beit HaMikdash when they are in states of mourning. Right. Right? There's this notion that mourning is antithetical to the house of the king. Right? Mm. Now, of course, there's also, you know, Esther going into the king and her life being hanging in the balance as she enters into the inner chambers of the king, which sounds very Yom Kippur, Kodesh HaKadoshim-like, and that the king has the power to grant life or death by extending his Sharvit. That sounds very godlike. I mean, the whole point is that he treats himself like a god, and his king, right, his castle is his sanctum.
Right.
Now, great. What does that have to do with the Parshiot? Right? Now, so this is something Ray Foreman points out that really brings us back to the Parsha, is, and this actually works very well with the Midrash. The Midrash says, why did Ahasuerus throw his insane party when he did? Which is, by the way, the craziest party ever. Right? Remember, 180 days of a party for the royalty followed by a 7-day party for everybody else is insane. Right? That's just crazy. I don't know. Maybe we've just been in yeshiva for 180 days. Do you understand how long of a party that is? Like a drunken orgy for 180 days. Okay?
It's a good time.
Amazing. What do Chazal say the point of the party was?
Legitimate his kingdom.
Well, Chazal actually have a very, very particular, right? Some of the Midrashim.
The Bis Mikdash.
Yes, he thought the 70 years were over and that this meant that he would be king forever because the prophecies weren't coming true and the Jews weren't going back to the Beit HaMikdash, right? In no uncertain terms, Chazal are telling you the point is that he thinks he replaces God and the Mikdash, and he only feels comfortable when he's confident that he's replaced God. So how does he inaugurate the new era?
Big party.
Yeah, what type of party? A 7-day party followed by a 1-day party.
Oh, it's like a chag.
No, it's like the inauguration of the Mishkan. In Sav, you have 7 days. Uvayom HaShmini, you have the 8th day where you try to take it up a level, right? Where you actually go into the Mikdash. And what does he do on the 8th day?
Kills Vash.
Well, no. First he tries to bring Vashti in, and then you get a reverse Shmini moment, right? Because Nadav and Avihu enter when they're not supposed to and get killed, and Vashti refuses to come in when she's called and gets killed / banished. Right? You have a 7-day followed by 8-day final celebration of party. Right? So Ray Foreman argues that, right, that following this Midrashic tradition, the Tanakh is trying to draw your attention to the fact that he really is trying to take over God, and therefore, you know, imbuing, again, sanctity, I'll use sanctity in the broader sense of the word, right? But sanctity is the wrong word. Divinity. Divinity is a great word in the ancient, the divine right of kings, right? To give divinity to his malchut, right? And the way you do that is with a 7-day inauguration followed by the 8th day climax, right? Which is exactly what he does. And then you get this fascinating inverted parallel where, again, we're Nadav and Avihu end that process by coming in when they're not supposed to, right? And Vashti refuses to come into the inner sanctum, right? And therefore gets killed. And therefore, as you sort of go through Tzav and Shmini, right? And you think of what it's like to have a godly abode in this world, you know, where there are laws and controls and we're in it for God and we're not totally losing ourselves, v'chule. Achashverosh, Purim, stands as the exact opposite of a person saying, no, I'm God, right? I am the only thing that's important. And what is the upshot of that? Instead of over and over, Kasher Tzivashem, Moshe, Zot Torah Ta'olah, Zot Torah HaMincha, all the laws and procedures, what is there?
Big party.
Yeah, not just a party. And one of my favorite moments in the entire Megillah is laws that are non-laws. right? The law was everyone should drink whatever they wanted and no one should force them, right? The law was that there is no law, right? It's literally the opposite. The dot, right? The dot, the law is that everyone does. Make sure that you impose that there is no rules, that no one be coerced to do anything and people do whatever they want, right? It is the total anarchy, right? The total self-indulgence, the antithesis of everything that the Mishkan stands for. And when you move to Shmini, of course, this this works even better with another midrash, right? Which is, again, a very plausible reading of Pshat, though not in Pshat, which is what was Nadav and Avihu's sin?
They were drunk.
Yeah, right? Because it's followed by the Isser to drink when you enter the Beit HaMikdash, right? Is that their problem wasn't they drunk, right? That when they go into the Beit HaMikdash, into the Mishkan, you're supposed to be in total control of your faculties, and to drink is antithetical to that. The Purim story, which is a 187-day drunken whatever, right, obviously stands as the anti-Mikdash in that sense. Okay, so those are just some thoughts on, you know, Tzav, Shmini, / Mishkan, versus Achashverosh. Again, there's a lot more that you can do with this, but those are just some initial thoughts to get you thinking. And again, none of this is in Pshat, right? This is all a lot of, right, Chazal see behind the scenes. And again, whether they mean this literally or not, or they just mean recognize that what Achashverosh is doing is deifying himself and therefore driving God out of the picture, right? Which is Pshat, right? That is Pshat, right? The fact that Achashverosh has deified himself, right, and has driven God out of the picture, that I think is Pshat in the Megillah. That's not like a, right? Whether he actually was using the Kelim in the Mikdash and consciously subverting God, that already is the Midrash. But Midrash is drawing attention to what is clearly there, and when then you look at it in contrast to the Mishkan, you do for sure see two different worldviews, which if nothing else is, right, the theme of the Megillah. Remember, that is the theme of the Megillah, that we have different laws than everybody else. Right, that is actually the theme of the part of the theme anyways of the Megillah. Okay, so those are just some thoughts for Tzav, Shmini, and Purim.